one that I did 2 weeks ago. Rabbi Berzon, of course, did last week. But the one that we did 2 weeks ago, we dealt with an ethical issue. And the challenge of taking advantage of or how to deal with a situation in which you have information and the other side does not have the same information you do. Not because of anything illegal, but you have superior information. Are you obligated to disclose? Are you not obligated to disclose? And we dealt with some real-world applications. Today is going to be all real-world applications. Three issues. The title, I think, that we originally had was Jewish Internet Etiquette. Shabbos, taxes, and email, something along those lines. The taxes topic is actually what I'm not going to end up going into, because I since learned that it's not the issue in Canada that it is in the United States. I was referring to the issue of online sales tax, which in the U.S. is very controversial, because the retailers tend not to collect it, and the buyers certainly aren't going to go send off to their sales tax to the government. And so there's quite a bit of struggle on this issue where the government claims it's being defrauded of a lot of money, and that's a war going on in the States. From what I understand, in Canada, it's pretty much taken care of. In Canada, online sales tax is collected and doesn't seem to be as controversial. So I didn't want to spend time on something that isn't such a practical issue here. Instead, I picked on three other topics that all relate to email. One, the issue of reading someone else's email. I walk into somebody's office to have a conversation, and there's an email up on the screen. Am I allowed to read it? Or, happens all the time, someone sends you an email that wasn't meant for you. Or here's a great one. Someone sends you an email, but you're like the third or fourth one in the chain, and they forwarded all the previous emails in the chain, including information that was never meant for you. So are you entitled to read that? That's topic number one. Topic number two, and I'm not asking you whether you have read those. That wasn't really the part of this discussion. Topic number two, it's Friday, and I have someone in Israel, and I want to email that person, or I want to send that person a fax. Am I allowed to do that, knowing that it's arriving in Israel at a time when it's already Shabbat there? Is that permissible? It's 7 hours ahead, and it's already Shabbos there. Am I allowed to send that person an email? Am I allowed to send that person a fax? That's part number two. And then part three is literally the etiquette issue. How you begin an email. Is there a Jewish way to start an email? That's the third piece of this. So I'd like to spend the next 40-45 minutes going through it. As I said in the first week of the series, please interrupt with questions. Don't wait till the end. I got myself in such trouble. 2 weeks ago, when I did the class here Wednesday, the next day I went to Heenan Blakey and did a lunch and learn there, and I invited them to interrupt me with questions in the middle. I got through some of my things. You ask a room full of lawyers to interrupt you in the middle. Yeah, it's your problem what happens next. In any case, that happened to be a great lunch and learn, by the way. That's not a knock on anyone who was there, including family members of people who are here today. Okay. So first, the issue of misdirected email. And there are actually five reasons within halacha and Jewish tradition for not reading the email that you see out there on the screen or the email that was misdirected to you. However, there are going to be some exceptions to these prohibitions. So the five reasons are, first of all, basic right to privacy. Judaism respects a person's right to say, this is mine, this is not for others to see. We value it, in fact. If you take a look at source number one, statement of the sages, they notice something interesting in the communications between God and Moshe in the wilderness. The Jews are traveling from Egypt into Israel. Every time God speaks to Moshe, or in the early stages, it's always out in public, with other people around, where anybody can witness it. Until suddenly, midway through the wilderness, he starts speaking to Moshe in a tent. The Ohel of Moshe, the tent of Moshe, or the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting. If you take a look here at source number one, I brought you the Hebrew as well as the English. And God spoke to Moshe in the Sinai wilderness until there was a tent of meeting, the Ohel Moed, as it's called in Hebrew. He spoke to Moshe at the bush, right, the burning bush where he first encounters him, and in Egypt, and in Midian, and in Sinai, meaning Mount Sinai. But when the tent of meeting was established, he said, privacy is good. God said, you know what? I like privacy. Privacy isn't such a bad thing in the Hebrew. Yafehi atzius. It's good for me, in fact, to be in private with Moshe. And he spoke to Moshe in the tent of meeting. And from then on, whenever God speaks to Moshe, it's in private. He doesn't want to be overheard. And this is reflected in numerous sources within Judaism. For example, take a look at source number 2, and it deals with issues of neighboring properties. I set up my house, you set up your house, I look out my window and I realize I can look into your window. The Gemara, the Talmud, is not a fan of that. Source number 2, we get a zoning rule. The Talmud has a volume called Bava Basra, which deals with all sorts of zoning issues. Partnerships, division of property, property rights, and this is one passage from there. The starting text, the Mishnah, going back to the 3rd century, says, Lo yiftach adam l'chatzer ashut fin pesach k'neged pesach. One may not open a window opposite a window, or a door opposite a door, across a yard owned in partnership. Remember the way that cities were laid out when you go back to Babylon and even in Israel, well, of 2,000 years ago. You had your main market thoroughfare. That's called in Hebrew Rishus HaRabim, the public area. Off of that, you would have roads that were called Mavoi that weren't just public. They basically led to houses. So you traveled it if you wanted to go to your house. Sometimes there were small businesses also along this Mavoi, along this road. Off of the road, you would hit what was called a chatzer, which would be a yard. And the yard was basically a cul-de-sac with houses that went all around that yard. This is the chatzer. So the expectation is no one goes into that yard unless they're going to the house, and the yard is actually jointly owned by members of the houses that live along the yard. So he says here that if I have a house on this side of the yard and you have a house on that side of the yard and you have a window right there in front, I'm not entitled to open a window in the wall of my house opposite your window. That's considered to be an invasion of your privacy. One may not increase their size, meaning I have a small window, I can't make it a big window, or turn one into two. I can't split one window into two windows, again, giving me more of a view. However, one may do this into a public domain. Why would we distinguish public domain? Why am I allowed to do that? In other words, it's not a yard between you and me, but now it's the public domain. It's the big public road. Why am I now allowed to open a window that's going to see right into yours?
Not jointly owned by the public.
There's no expectation of privacy. And that's going to be a very important piece of this discussion about reading the email. There are times when we say, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And we include someone whose house is sitting on the road. Because you can't tell me, as everybody rides down the street on their horses and donkeys and camels, that they're not looking into your window. You're complaining about my house that I can see in. Worry about everybody else. So the Gemara, commenting on this Mishnah, the sages ask, how do we know this? How do we know that there's an expectation of privacy? Rabbi Yochanan said, still in source number 2, and Bilam raised his eyes and saw Israel dwelling in its tribes. This is talking about Bilam, who is hired by the nation of Moab to go curse the Jewish people. The Jews are, again, on their way into the land known then as Canaan. And they're on their way into the land known as Canaan. It's a great table for doing that. And the nation of Moab is very scared. They don't live in Canaan. They actually live east of Canaan. However, they are concerned that the Jews are entering and that the Jews are going to use up all of their resources. There goes the neighborhood as the Jews move in. And therefore, they hire this man Bilam to pray to God to harm the Jews. That's effectively Bilam's job. And Bilam instead ends up praising this Jewish nation. And one of the things that it says there that in that portion is Bilam raised his eyes and saw Israel dwelling in its tribes. And the sages are bothered. What does that mean, dwelling in its tribes? What did he see? That the entrances of their tents were not aligned. You set up your tent, you set up your house, so that you can't see into someone else's entrance. And he said, these people are suited for the divine presence. These people are a wonderful people. Privacy as a value. And based on that, we say that in practice in Jewish law, you have to respect somebody else's privacy. So, for example, source number 3 deals with an easement issue. They often built two-story houses in which you have a lower floor and then you have an upper floor. The access to the upper floor was through the outside. Now, you had this yard that we've talked about next to the house. And the question is, does the person who lives in the upper floor have the right to use the space in the yard below? Let's say there's a shelf in the yard below, just below the upper floor, and he wants to use that for storage. of his things. But from that, he's going to be able to see whatever the person from the lower floor is doing when he accesses that that shelf. So source number three, again, the same section of the Talmud that deals with zoning issues, we're taught, a shelf smaller than a few inches does not demonstrate an easement, and its owner cannot protest its elimination, meaning, I buy the upper floor of the house. The previous resident had access to a shelf, but it was only a shelf that was a few inches long. It's not a serious shelf. The tenant in the lower floor takes advantage of the opportunity to get rid of this shelf that's been bothering him forever. I say, wait a minute, I have an easement there. That was there before. I have the right to use that shelf. He says, no. The existence of a small little shelf like that, that's not something you were planning on using when you moved in. It's not considered significant. Therefore, you don't have access to it. And Rav Huna said, the owner of the yard may protest to the owner of the roof and say to him, I don't want you to have such a shelf there. Rav Yehuda said, even the owner of the yard may not protest to the owner of the roof. Rav Yehuda disagreed. He says, you can't protest the existence of the shelf. What are they disagreeing about? Is this a debate about harm via sight, that one considers it true harm and the other does not? In other words, is this a privacy issue? One of them says, you can protest because you don't want him to be looking into your area when he uses that shelf. And the other one says, you can't protest because we don't consider it harmful for him to be able to see. You follow the debate here? I'm doing it a little quickly. I'm sorry, because I planned to cover a lot. But we have a debate as to whether the person below can complain about use of this shelf. So is it because one of them values privacy and the other one does not value privacy? He says, no. No, all recognize harm via sight, what's called in the Gemara's terminology, Talmudic terminology, hezek ra'iya, damage by seeing. Everybody calls that an invasion of privacy, and everybody considers that to be substantive harm. If someone else looks into my yard, he's hurting me. Then what's the debate about with the shelf? This case is unique. For the owner of the roof protests that he will not look. He says, look, all I want to do is use this for storage. Right? When I was in college, we were only allowed to have a certain size fridge in the dorms at YU. And inevitably, it didn't fit everything that we wanted. But that was okay, because like 5 months out of the year, it was freezing outside. So we hung things out the window. That was the way we managed. So here you have somebody in the Middle East, I'm guessing he doesn't get much refrigeration by putting things out the window. Nonetheless, he's keeping something on the shelf outside. He says, I don't want to look into your yard. I don't want to look into your house. I don't want to see what you're doing. I just want to keep my stuff out here. That's all I'm doing. To which the other replies, the one living below, says, sometimes he will be frightened of falling and he'll look. Meaning, he's going to be using the shelf. Apparently the intent is not just that I put stuff down and I take stuff off, but I'm standing there at some point. And the concern is, you're going to end up unintentionally looking into my property, and therefore I protest your access to that space. That's the debate. But the takeaway piece for us is that everybody involved in the debate about the shelf considers privacy to be very important, and considers violation of privacy to be an act of substantive harm. Another example is in source number 4, the Code of Jewish Law talks about dividing up a jointly owned yard. Each partner in a divided yard may force the other to contribute to construction of a partition in the middle to keep him from seeing when the other uses his property. So in other words, I own a yard with you. It's not jointly owned. We decide we're going to split it up. I say to you, I want a privacy wall. You say, I'm not interested in a privacy wall. I trust you. I'm fine with it. Doesn't matter. I can compel you to contribute to the construction of a privacy wall. It's considered to be normal for me to expect that I'll be able to use my space without someone else looking in. And he said, this is true even after they dwell for many years without a partition. And Rabbi Moshe Isserles adds, this is even true if local custom is not to have a partition. So there, this is already a Talmudic law, but it's codified here in the Code of Jewish Law in the beginning of the 16th century, that you're entitled to privacy. And that's one reason why you can't read my email. So if I accidentally sent you an email that included information that I didn't mean to give you, it was forwarded from a previous thing, or if I sent you an email by accident, I love Gmail's autocomplete, right? I'm not going to ask how many people have been victimized by autocomplete, but I'm sure it's not just me. If I send you an email, and then afterwards I follow up saying, don't read that, please, that was a mistake, then you're not allowed to read it because we value privacy. That's number one. Number two, there's the issue of what's called in Hebrew rechilus or rechilut. Anybody know what rechilut means? Rechilus?
Gossip.
Right? Gossip is usually the way we take it, but what we take this to mean in practice comes from the term rachil. A rachil is a
slander.
Peddler. Thank you. A rachil is a peddler. And the Torah says, "Lo seilech rachil be'amecha." You shall not go about as a peddler in your nation. That's the Torah's statement. And what's wrong with being a peddler? There are plenty of Jewish peddlers. God knows, if you tell me that the Torah prohibits being a peddler, you know what would have happened to the Jews at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, let alone earlier in history. The Torah is not prohibiting Jews from being peddlers. Rather, what it's prohibiting is going around from person to person peddling stories. And the definition of gossip and telling stories in Rechilus is different from what people are more familiar with, the issue of Lashon Hara, where Lashon Hara says, don't speak negatively about others. Rechilus, the prohibition against gossip, has nothing to do with whether it's negative or positive. I'm not allowed to go around telling people about things that are going on in other people's lives. Now, there are limits on that, because, for example, someone has a baby, right? I'd like to be able to say mazel tov and to tell people, let everybody know, hey, so-and-so had a baby. Or, God forbid, the other end of things, someone suffers a loss. You can't tell me that the person who just lost a parent has to now inform everybody because no one's allowed to send out an email saying, so-and-so lost a parent. That's nonsense. There are certain expectations that information may be shared. But as a general principle, we're taught not to share information about others. Good, bad is irrelevant.
You sent an email? Mm-hmm. The email's off already. You decide you don't want to send it anymore. You send it to people like I can't open the original email?
That's what I'm suggesting.
How could that be?
What do you mean?
If you throw something out on the street, like, and you don't want to keep it anymore, and then you decide later on, oh, I want to bring it back into the house, and somebody's already taken it, you've already put it into the public domain, or you've already sent it to the person. Like, I don't understand why you'd be able to take that back. You can do a favor.
Well, is that the same? In other words, you're comparing throwing something out with sending an email out by mistake. What if I throw something out by mistake?
If someone takes it, you turn it out already.
Right. See, I think we're looking at it from two different sides. You're looking at it, I think, in terms of property.
Yeah.
And once I sent it, it's off the reservation. Now it's wherever it is. I'm not looking at it in terms of physical property. I'm looking at it in terms of the privacy involved and saying that the privacy persists even after this physical object is no longer my possession. In the email, there's no physical object.
You sent it away, you've given away any rights to privacy.
I think you're saying two separate things.
One second. I finish that and then I'll go to you.
No, if you sent it away, you've given away your rights to privacy. If you've sent it out, that's all it is. You've sent it away from somebody, you've sent away with a privacy for something that really isn't in your possession anymore. You sent an email, let me say, everybody sent that email, it's my mistake. But if someone sent me an email right after, oh, don't read that. Like, I can do them the favor and I'd open it, but I don't think I'm wrong if I do open it or I opened it before.
Okay, hang on. Yehuda?
I was just going to say, what I heard you saying is that when I initially sent the email, it was a mistake. So I was trying to send to somebody, and I accidentally sent it to you. What I heard Shirley ask the first time was that I really meant to send it to you, but then after I sent it, I decided, you know, I don't want you to see that anymore, so I followed up with an email saying, please don't open it. Those are two separate things. If I never intended to send it to you in the first place, I think that's what we're talking about here, that you don't have the right
to
send
it. It was a mistake.
But if I intended to send you, then I just decided, you know what?
That's part of the conventional email.
It's a mistake.
It's like you send out a letter to somebody. I don't understand why it would be any different from a regular mistake.
We do have concepts of mistakes. We do say that where you perform an action which is dependent upon certain intent,
right,
and then you discover that your intent was predicated on a mistake, you're not bound by it.
It's forbidden to open it.
Let's take the following case. Let's get away from privacy for a second. I buy something off of you. Okay? We'll take the case from 2 weeks ago, the grain discussion. Okay? In one of the cases that we discussed then, there are boats coming downstream carrying grain. Okay? I need grain, and I know the price is very high, and I sell something very valuable of mine. In the case there, they actually sold their homes because I can't afford food without it. So I sell my home in order to get the food. I then discover that had I waited another hour, there would have been cheap food available. So the conclusion there is that I'm allowed to go back to the people who bought the houses from me and say, it was a mistake, it was all done, a mistaken supposition, and the sale is reversed. It's what we call mekartos. It's a transaction entered into by mistake. And that's exactly what's going on here. I did give you, I gave up my privacy by sending it to you, but it was based on an error. I thought you were somebody else.
The transaction entered into by mistake. You made it with all the knowledge you had at the time. I don't know, like, there's no take of axes. I guess there is.
There is. That's the answer. The answer is that there are axes. I didn't know if the term axes applied in Canada. Yeah, but I think there is. I think there very much is. If I do something by mistake, I am able to reverse it. That's the idea. We're going to see more about this because there are all sorts of nuances. We haven't gone into some of the more complex cases. Like if I send an email to an account knowing that two people have access to the email on that account, then what do you do? So we have to see more about what exactly is involved in surrendering my right to privacy. But the default assumption is indeed that information is assumed to be private until it's established otherwise. For the best example of this, take a look at source number 5. This is a classic. The most common sentence in the entire Torah is, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor. God told Moshe, go tell this to the nation. So look what the Gemara does with that. Minayin la'omer davar lachaveru shehu bebal yomar. How do we know that one may not repeat that which he is, sorry about that, that not he is, not is he, that which he is told, achiyomar lo lechemor, until he is told, go tell it. How do I know that if someone says something to me, I'm not allowed to go repeating it, unless he tells me, go ahead and repeat this. Shneamar, because the Torah says, vayidaber Hashem elav me'ol hamoed lemor. God told Moshe in the tent of meeting to tell the nation and so on. So that if a person doesn't say to me, go tell it, I am not entitled to repeat it. Based on that, take a look at source number 6, the work of Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz, who was a rabbi in 17th century Morocco. I put it on your sheet there. He then moved to Israel. He was a very big opponent of Shabtai Tzvi, the false messiah of the 1650s, 1660s. And he actually ended his life in Turkey. The Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz did. Well, so did Shabtai Tzvi. But in any case, he addresses this issue and he introduces us to a new point with his with what he says here on it. I'm going to need to explain it a little bit. There's a separate reason not to read someone else's mail. And we're going to come to it a little bit later. But it's a decree made by Rabbeinu Gershom, who was the leading authority in Jewish law in the Ashkenazi community in the 10th century. So he made a decree that you shouldn't read other people's mail in general. And people, in fulfillment of this decree or in observance of this decree, would write on their letters, He, Gimel, Yud, Nun. 4 Hebrew letters they would write on their mail. He, Gimel, Yud, Nun stands for Poreitz Geder Yishchenu Nachash, which is a verse in Kohelas, Ecclesiastes. It means one who breaks through a fence will be bitten by a snake. That's what they would write on their mail. Which is a good warning, I think, for people. In general, it's a good warning. So they would write that on their mail. So look at this. Question that's asked Rabbi Yaakov Chagiz. His work of responsa is called Halachot Ketanot, small laws, because he writes very briefly. His responsa are all very terse. Sheila, the question is there substance in the practice of writing Pe Gimel Yud Nun on letters? That's the question that's asked. Do you have to write those 4 letters in order for people to be prohibited from reading your mail? Are those letters magic, is the question. To which he answers, no, even without it, one still may not seek another's secrets. What is the difference between divulging others' secrets to others and to oneself? In other words, if I read something that's not meant for me, it's just like gossip. The difference is that in gossip, I convey it to somebody else. In here, I am letting myself in on the secret of somebody else. But there's no fundamental difference. You are spreading information beyond the person for whom it was intended. It happens to be that I am the person who's beyond the intended party. So that's a second reason why privacy is important and one may not read somebody else's mail. The first is the basic right to privacy. The second is the issue of rechilus, of gossip. Third is one I didn't bring a source for on the sheet. It's self-explanatory, although Rabbi Chaim Palagi did discuss it in a work of responsa called Chikike Leiv, and that is Ve'hapta L'Reacha Kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself, right? Which we're taught means don't do things to other people if you wouldn't want them done to you. If you wouldn't want it done to you, don't do it to somebody else. And I think that's also a fairly good rationale for not reading something that is of somebody else. The fourth of the 5 explanations for why one may not is the issue of theft. It may well constitute theft. And there's some controversy on that, whether it really constitutes theft or not, because it's information. It's not a physical object that you're actually stealing. And then fifth is indeed this decree of Rabbeinu Gershom from the 10th century. If you take a look at source number 7, it's as cited by Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein, Rabbi of Novardok, at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. He says, and here he introduces us to some of the questions we need to discuss. He says, one may not read his friend's letter without permission unless he throws it out. He throws it out, now I can read it. And then he says, I am uncertain regarding the modern practice of sending open letters via the mail. What's he talking about?
Postcards.
Right. He's talking about sending a postcard. They may one read them, since the writers do not hide them. If you write it out in the open, is it my fault for having read it? So this introduces us to two key exceptions. Exception number one, his point about that which is thrown away. What if somebody throws it away? Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein, in source number 7, says if he throws it out, now it's his problem. But we have three caveats. Number one, who threw it out? The sender threw it out or the recipient threw it out? If the recipient throws it out, am I entitled to read it?
No.
No, why not?
Because the sender might not want you to read it.
Right. It's not necessarily his, the recipient's right to decide what I should be able to read of what the sender wrote. If it's his own private document, he wrote up some notes for himself, a diary, whatever it was, and he threw it out. So that was his decision. But if somebody else sent him a letter, he doesn't have the right to decide, well, it's okay for Torchino to read this. That's not an option. That's number one. Yeah.
So wouldn't that thing, what you're only saying is if you almost can't BCC someone on an email, because you're involving someone else into an issue that, you know, a person only you know, if I'm sending you an email and I want my friend here to be included on it, but I don't want you to know that
right.
He's included on it, almost.
Right. So I don't know that BCC violates this in particular, but I do. I am against BCC for the but not from this. I'm against BCC because you fundamentally set up a misunderstanding. In other words, I'm communicating with someone who thinks that I'm only communicating with him, but in fact I'm divulging it to a third party. There's an element of deception that's involved. I don't know that you could actually codify that as law, because the deception may not harm him in any way. It may be innocent. There are BCCs that everybody, I think, accepts as normal. For example, you have an assistant, and the assistant needs to know about some issue that's going on, but they're not really part of the discussion. So you BCC so they can know what's happening without necessarily engaging in the conversation. That, I think, is a different story to people, as opposed to, I'm going to write him a letter and BCC it to somebody else who can see how much I'm embarrassing him. You know, this is a different story. Yes.
I don't see that's deception. It would be deception if when the person then replied, without knowing about it, they were also replying to the BCC, which we know you can't do.
Right, you can't.
I could technically, if I don't BCC him, I wanted to see how I sent an email to him making fun of him, I could easily just forward it to him and say, look at the email I just sent him. I mean, I don't see why that
right.
would be
deception. And maybe forwarding is just as bad.
Right.
I'm not saying forwarding is any better. I'm not a fan of the BCC method, because I think it does set up an untrustworthy situation. But I don't think halachically you could prohibit it on that basis. From a Jewish law perspective, I'm not sure that would be a problem.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Are you saying then that, just to go back to previously what we said about the Aruch HaShulchan, that I should not be throwing out a letter, maybe I should destroy it, but I should not throw out a letter from another person because there's confidentiality there.
Exactly. Exactly. There's a second caveat, and that's actually your question. The question of a person who demonstrates desire for privacy. Let's say he throws it out, but he shreds it. Does that mean now I'm entitled? I'm not asking this really. But as a general rule, the person has demonstrated that he doesn't want people reading it. Am I entitled to piece it together? Or maybe the shredder didn't do its job well, and there are parts of it that I'm able to read. So it would seem, since the reason why I'm allowed to read something someone throws out is because it's a given that he doesn't care, he threw it out, if he demonstrates he does care, such as by shredding it, then I'm not entitled to read it. Third, I can't read his mind. Meaning, sometimes the item may well be available, And I assume that means it's available because he doesn't care who sees it. But the truth is, it may have become available through some other means. For example, you go to a website and you stumble on a document there that really should not have been public. It may be public because they don't care. It may become public because someone in the IT department wasn't careful and didn't properly protect it. So, how do you know that? You don't.
There's a certain default, though. You know when you have, if there's a certain confidential document, even when you get an email, a lot of people will encrypt it or they'll give you a certain password you have to get into. But if people are sending out emails and on the bottom it doesn't say it's confidential or any of that sort of stuff, nowadays I think it's pretty much common that that's a lot more open than if you're getting a confidential missive or a...
Right. So I think there are certain defaults. I think that's true. We don't necessarily need to go to the ends of the earth in our assumptions about people's motives. But if I have some indication that this really wasn't meant to be public and it happened by accident, then I have to be concerned about that. It's where I get a sense of this really wasn't supposed to be, in my field of vision. They had this story last week from New York. There was a police station near Times Square that did a conference of police chiefs on security measures. And it said on it in big, bold letters, shred this, do not release, whatever it was. And some guy found it in the trash can outside of the police station. He published it online.
WikiLeaks.
Right, except not even WikiLeaks. It's just, I don't know what to call it, WikiCareless. It was just... out there lying in the trash can on the street. Anybody could have come along and found it. So the argument could be made, that they didn't mean this to be out there. You know that this happened by mistake, therefore you shouldn't be reading it. But again, I care about the person's intent. I'm not as concerned about the physical state of the item.
Are we more conscious vis-a-vis privacy than we are by Lashon Hara?
Meaning?
Lashon Hara, there's exceptions whereby if it was said in front of X amount of people, said more than three people, so then there's a certain permissive element to spreading that information. So here, an email sent to God knows how many people, whatever, or if something was forwarded around, or if that document was posted online, you could safely assume three people saw it or however many people saw it.
Right. So you're right. That will eliminate some of the concerns. If the person himself is publicizing it, even within a certain group, then that will eliminate certain concerns of mine. Where it may not eliminate is the issue of v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. If he decides, I don't want so-and-so to know, and he is taking some measures to make sure that person doesn't find out, I don't have the right to divulge it.
So, what's the halakhic point, though, if I still don't see the difference if once you throw something out into public domain, whether intentionally or unintentionally, it still ends up in the public domain. So the question is, whether intentionally or unintentionally, the person gave up their ownership of an item or of an email or whatever. So they can't just take it back if someone else already has it.
Why not?
Because it's in the public domain.
Right, but what does the public domain mean? But in practice, what is the public domain? It's just a set of rules that we've defined for how society functions.
Right.
So it's just as legitimate to say we have a rule that says if a person accidentally puts something out there for public consumption and then wants to retract, he has the right to do so. That's all we're doing. It's not as though this... Frankly, it's not a Jewish-specific idea. I think that from a secular standpoint, the same idea obtains, that you're not able to use information that someone divulged by accident, or that someone divulged in certain limited circumstances, never intending for it to go any further.
Insider trading.
Patient-physician privilege. Right, this comes up all the time. People divulge information either by mistake or on purpose, but intended to be limited. So what do you do if the information is open and there is no indication of his intent for privacy? Or what if someone sends an email in an office system knowing full well that it's a monitored system, that the administration of the company actually is reading the emails? What if it's a fax and it's to a jointly owned fax? It's the fax for the entire floor, so anybody could come along and read that fax. What if it's a jointly held email account? there's a husband and wife who share a personal email account. You know, is there any reason why you should have an expectation of privacy? So the answer seems to be that it's open. Once you put something in an arena where you know that others have access, you can't claim I want privacy. It's hard to mind read somebody's intent, but there are certain actions which we can take as a statement of what the person had in mind. That's all first topic. Now, we had set up originally three topics, but I see we have like 10 minutes to go. So my question is, do we want to deal with the sending an email to a place where it's already Shabbos, or do we want to deal with the question of how you start an email? Shabbos? Start an email? All right, I'm going to go with the Shabbos one. Oh, well, starting an email also comes up all the time. Yeah, but I'm going to deal with the Shabbos one and give you like a one-liner on the starting an email thing at the end. And you see, I gave you some sources on it, so you'll be able to take a look at those. Sending an email to a place where it is Shabbos. So there are two key questions that require discussion in order to address it. Well, three key questions that need to be addressed. Question number one: I send the email or I send the fax. I am causing malacha, actions that are prohibited on Shabbos, to take place in a place where it is already Shabbos. I send the fax, I'm causing the fax machine to print it out, I'm causing the server to deliver it to deliver the email on the other side. Is that a problem? The answer seems to be no, it's not a problem. And the insight comes from a comment that you see here in source number 8. I'm going to do it outside of the text, but you can see it there. Rabbi Yosef ibn Chabib, in his commentary to the Talmud, called Nimuke Yosef, he deals with an interesting question. When you deal with laws of damages, they address the question of a person who lights a fire, and then the fire spreads and consumes other people's property. So what's his liability for the fire? And the rule is that if I light a fire, it's considered like shooting an arrow. Just like a person who shoots an arrow or fires a gun is responsible for everything that happens as the arrow or the bullet travels its path, so too a person who lights a fire is responsible for whatever the fire does in the course of its normal path. So he asks a question. I light a candle before Shabbos. I light Shabbos candles. That means that I am responsible for the continued burning of the candles into Shabbos itself. So why am I able to light a candle before Shabbos? Right? The old argument that some indeed wanted to make, that you shouldn't be able to have Shabbos candles. Because it's as though I am lighting it every step of the way. Just like I am responsible, if I light a fire and it burns down 10 houses, because at each stage it's as though I am burning down that house actively, so too, it's as though for the duration of this flame's burning, I am responsible for that flame. That's the question that he asks in source number 8. And his answer is that it's not quite the same. And the reason it's not quite the same is that my responsibility for what this flame does is not throughout the flame's life. It's at the moment of lighting. In other words, it's as though everything that's going to happen in its life is happening right at this moment. So if I light a fire and it burns 10 houses, I am responsible right now, as though it's happening right now. And if I light a flame for Shabbos, my act of lighting is complete for the duration of its existence right now at this moment before Shabbos. That's how he explained how you can have Shabbos candles. It's a great topic and it's worthy of its own discussion, but I'm going to take it as a given for now. And Rabbi J. David Bleich, writing in Contemporary Halachic Problems, Volume 5, says that the same thing is true regarding me sending the email, not over time, but over space. Just like when I light the candle, we look at what time it is when I light the candle. So too, when I send the email or send the fax, we look at the space where I am now. Not where it's going to travel over the duration of its existence, but where it is right now. And where it is right now, it's not Shabbos. So therefore, he said, since I, the actor, the one who's doing something, I'm in a location where it's not Shabbos, I'm okay.
So even if you know you're causing someone in Israel or wherever it is to be called Shabbos.
So we haven't gotten yet to the actions of the person on the other side. It's a good question. Hang on. Right now we're just concerned about the fact that I myself triggered an event in a place where it was Shabbos, not the person reading it. The second question is, well, what about the fact that my machine on the other end, assuming it's my machine on the other end, is working for me on Shabbos? I'm sending an email or sending a fax to my machine on the other side. Is there a requirement for me to have my property rest on Shabbos? That's called in Hebrew, Shavisas Kelim. And the answer is no. Based on the Gemara in source number 9, it's codified in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 10. We are not instructed to have our implements rest. My property does not need to rest on Shabbos. I have to rest. My property does not. Granted that in source number 11, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, quotes a passage from the Yerushalmi, from the Jerusalem Talmud, which I'm again speeding through, where he says that the rule is that you have to refrain from active work, and apparently from having your implement engage in active work on Shabbos. He says that the Chasam Sofer does say that. However, Rabbi Lau, chief rabbi of the previous chief rabbi of the state of Israel, argues in an article in Tehumen that that's only if it's Shabbos on that spot. In other words, basically what emerges from source number 11 is that if someone isn't Jewish and he's going to take my axe and start cutting wood with it on Shabbos, I do have a problem. Even though you said that I'm responsible to make sure, even though you said that I'm not responsible to make sure that my property rests on Shabbos, nonetheless, I can't have someone who isn't Jewish work with my property there. That's in source number 11. Nonetheless, he says, that's only if he's doing the work where it actually is Shabbos. And in the case that we're discussing, it's not. Where I am, it's not actually Shabbos. There is no problem with my implement doing work, and even with me causing my implement to do work, as long as where I am, it's currently not Shabbos. That's the idea. If you take a look at source number 12, the top of the third side, Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, in fact, gave the following ruling, dealing with it from the other side of things. He says, if a non-Jew phones from a land where it is Shabbat already, okay, someone isn't Jewish, he's calling me from England, and it's Friday afternoon, so for him it's already Friday night. Of course, for him, he's not Jewish. So he's calling me from where it is Shabbat already. A Jew may speak with him in another land where Shabbat has not yet begun. I can have the conversation knowing that I'm activating the phone on the other side when I speak, and that's not considered a problem. My voice is emerging on the other side, but for me, it's not Shabbos. The Rav Herschel Schechter actually disagrees with this, based on a modern edition of the Rambam that was not known until very recently. In an article in 2005, Rav Schechter wrote that in fact one should not do this. He said that if you look carefully at this new edition of the Rambam seems to say that while if work starts on Friday, it can continue into Shabbos, I would not be allowed to actually set it up so that the work would begin on Shabbos. That he won't allow. So calling somebody where it's already Shabbos, the work is now starting. Or much more substantively for us, it happens all the time, Shabbos clocks. Rav Schechter would not be a fan of setting up a Shabbos clock to turn on a light, to turn on heating and air conditioning, and so on. Of course, as he himself notes in his writing, everybody in the world at this point relies on Shabbos clocks. But what he's suggesting would, in fact, overturn all of that. So in sum, and again, I apologize for rushing through that. Maybe it would have been a good idea to wait with that till next time. But Rav Schechter's statement is, I'm sorry, Rav Schechter, the general assumption is that, number one, when I start it going where it's not Shabbos, all I care about is the fact that I am outside of Shabbos, and that's good enough, just like I can light Shabbos candles before Shabbos, and they can continue to burn into Shabbos. And number two, I'm not responsible for my property to rest on Shabbos. And therefore, it's okay for me to call in. Now, you ask the question, well, what about causing somebody on the other side to violate Shabbos? So it's certainly true that I should avoid that. I should not send it to someone who would not have read it, except that I told them, hey, I'm going to be sending you an email. That's certainly true. On the other hand, I don't have to worry when I send it, someone might turn on his computer to read my email. And if he's already reading email anyway, then I'm not actually having him do anything in addition. So it's not necessarily an issue. In general, there are many leniencies on this issue of causing somebody else to sin in this regard, because you're not forcing somebody else to do something. You're not putting the sin in his hand. You're creating a possibility for him to do something that he's going to choose on his own to do or not to do. Yeah.
So that's what you're almost saying, though, is Jewish etiquette to write an email should have the disclaimer up above and then the actual email below.
Yeah.
You're going back to the first point, the issue of reading and not reading the emails.
Right.
Yes. I mean, I don't think it has to be, because I think it's a given. It's an assumption. But it shouldn't be boilerplate that people ignore. That's for sure true.
It's only a matter of time until someone invents an email that can't be opened on Shabbos.
They have that already. My computer does that every other week. Yeah.
Just a quick thing on the Shabbos candles. I don't even understand the question. The prohibition against lighting a fire and doing any malacha is you may not do an action. It doesn't say an action must not exist. So Torah says Lo Sevarish, you shall not light a fire. It doesn't say you shall not have a fire lit. So why would there even be a question?
Right. Because the way it's framed in the discussion of tort law and responsibility for damage as a result of my fire is that it sounds like I am actually considered to be lighting the fire every moment as it's going along. It's not only the moment where it starts. Until Nemuka Yosef comes along with this clarification, that's how they make it sound. In the same way that I am liable for every instant of the flight of my arrow or my bullet, I am responsible as though I'm relighting the flame at every instant of its travel. That's why it's a question. You're right. Regarding Shabbos, the wording is in terms of kindling it rather than simply having it burning. The last part about the politeness issue is simply that the emails really should begin with hello. They should begin with a salutation. I am as guilty as anybody else of not always doing this, but I try really hard not to be guilty of it. If you take a look at source 13, this is the classic source. Moshe goes up to the top of Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, and Hashem is writing the Torah. And he sees God writing the Torah, and he watches what God is doing. And God turns to Moshe and says, Moshe, ain't shalom b'ircha. There's no shalom in your area. They don't know where you come from. They don't know to begin by saying hello. That's God's rebuke to Moshe, is don't you know to say hello? And the Ritva, commenting on that Gemara, says this is teaching us derech eretz, that you should greet people with a salutation. Not only that, as you continue down the sources, I won't read them out loud, but source 14 says you should greet everybody that way. The Maharal, Rabbi Yehuda Lowe, in source 15 says that's even somebody who is wicked. You know, you say, well, I don't want to waste a hello on him. Well, he doesn't think he's wicked. He thinks he's a good person. He just thinks you're rude. So the message of not giving him a hello is going to be lost upon him. The Source 16, we find that the sages were careful to do this for everybody, lest one think somehow this is a special privilege for members of the clan that you greet them politely. No, this is for everybody, that you try to greet them politely. The Mechilta, the Medrash in Source 17, shows that they even bowed and kissed when they greeted. It was considered to be normal. Don't do that in an email. And source 18 says that one should make sure to respond, certainly, to a greeting. If one doesn't respond when greeted politely, it's actually considered an act of theft. One should always respond that way. Now, there are, of course, default conventions to the way people communicate. Meaning, I sent you an email and you sent me back an email. We went back and forth five times today. You know, I think after the first round, it's fair to say we're not necessarily expected to say hello. When I say 10:30 and you say back 10:45 or whatever it is, and say hello 10:30, hello 10:45. But that it should begin with a degree of politeness is a very important point from the Torah's perspective. A lot of ink, so to speak, is spent on this topic, and so I think it's something that we should keep in mind as part of internet etiquette. Right. No, I think that when you have a limit on your space that you can use, and it's understood that it's the temporary communication, I view that as more part of an ongoing conversation, which doesn't require a hello, because in the same way that when I'm speaking to you and we're going back and forth, I don't say hello with every sentence, the text message communication isn't like that. But every new encounter, you know, really should begin with a measure of politeness. We like polite. Okay, thank you very much.